joint work with my former student Ivan Todorov and Vern here. Ivan was going to be here. Unfortunately, he's been detained by the Bulgarian army, so he won't make it. But I hope to speak about our joint work to make up for this. About the title, I was thinking about the word ternary. Ternary is Latin for triple, which is Greek. So I should be saying triple rings, but to a Greek, ternary, you know, sounds more distinguished. So I thought I'd stick to ternary. Of course, to an Italian, ternary sounds, well, I don't know. And all that is a reference to a book by my advisor, Ray Streeter and Whiteman, called PCT, Spin and Statistics and All That, and not to what you might think is 1066 and all that. What are normalizers? Of course you know, but I will repeat it. So if you have a Feynman algebra in B of H, I'll always be in B of H. I won't get out of B of H in this talk at least. An operator would normalize the algebra when T star AT is in the algebra, and also TAT star is in the algebra. And we then say that T is in N of A. I want to generalize this in two separate directions. I want to replace the algebra by two algebras, A and B, which I would not necessarily require to be von Neumann algebras. And also, I want to look at these two relations separately. So my setting will be the following. I will look at two reflexive algebras. I will tell you later, well, you know, but I will tell you anyway, what reflexive algebra is. And then I will have an operator from one Hilbert space to the other. And I will say that normalizes B into A when T star BT is in A, and also TAT star is in B. And I will say then that T belongs to the normalizers of B into A. And we have found that each of these relations by itself does something interesting. So I will say that T semi-normalizes B into A when it satisfies only the first relation. So I will define the set Fn of BA to be the set of semi-normalizers of B into A. And this is the object of study of the first part of my talk. Now, I need to tell you about reflexivity. The way I want to think about reflexivity is as a generalization of the notion of a von Neumann algebra. A von Neumann algebra is something that satisfies the Biacomedon theorem. So that can be reformulated as saying that it's a set of all operators that commute with a bunch of projections. What projections? The projections, the Biacomedon, of course. So a direct generalization of this to the non-self-adjoint situation, to the thoroughgoingly non-self-adjoint situation, is the notion of a reflexive algebra, where you look at all operators that do this to a bunch of projections. Here, we're talking about the A invariant projection. So a reflexive algebra is an algebra consisting of all operators that leave invariant a certain set of projections. This is Halmos. And to generalize further, and this is Login of Schulman, it's Login of Schulman Erdos. Let us say that a subspace of operators from H1 to H2 is reflexive when it consists of all operators that do something to a bunch of projections. Do something. The something is determined by this map phi. So you have a bunch of projections. I don't want to specify at the moment what I mean by that, but you have a set of projections on the Hilbert space H1, and you look at all operators that send these projections or these subspaces to some other projections called phi of L. And you call that a reflexive subspace. Okay, so I have normalizers over here and a reflexivity over there. And I want now to combine the two notions. I am being David Bletcher. I'll be finished by 20 past. I'm going to combine the two notions and talk to you about semi-normalizers of reflexive algebras. And of course, there's no reason for the set of semi-normalizers to have any linear structure. If you add two semi-normalizers, you definitely don't get a semi-normalizer. In fact, it's very rare that you get one, and I might tell you at the end some cases where you do. But what I will claim is that this set, which in the case where you consider two algebras is not even a semigroup. If you had one algebra, if A were B, then that would be a semigroup under composition. But if you have two, it's not even a semigroup. It possesses what I call local linear structure. And let me try and explain what that is. So you do the following. Given... Okay, thanks. So given two reflexive algebras and the semi-normalizer of B into A, you define a map from the invariant lattice of A to the invariant lattice of B by sending a projection L to the projection onto what T does to L, and then saturated with all operators in B. Okay, that gives you a subspace. You look at the projection onto it, and you call that phi T of L. Now, what you can show is that as a consequence of the fact that T is a semi-normalizer of B into A, in other words, as a consequence of the fact that T satisfies this condition here, what you can show is that T satisfies this relation, which is similar but not the same to the relation that I had before that defined reflexive algebra, reflexive subspace, I'm sorry. Remember before I said that T belonged to reflexive subspace if it satisfied this property. Now I have this equality, which of course implies this. But that's stronger. So I want to compare the relation between these two equalities to the relation between the equality defining a reflexive algebra and the equality defining a von Neumann algebra. Again, you have the same phenomenon. There's an L missing on the right. So let us proceed with this line of thought a little bit and look at this map phi from lat A to lat B, or for that matter, look at any map from lat A to lat B satisfying some mild properties. So it will be preserve the zero subspace, and it will also preserve order. So it will preserve arbitrary suprema, but not infima. So now you construct the set of all operators from H1 to H2, satisfying such an equality. And that is, of course, a reflexive linear space. That is, of course, a reflexive linear space. But what you can show, not with a lot of difficulty, is that all operators in this space are actually semi-normalizers. So I've presented for you a linear space consisting of semi-normalizers. Moreover, by construction, the operator T belongs to the to this subspace. And therefore, what I've proved is that the set of all semi-normalizers from B into A is the union of a bunch of linear spaces, union overall semi-normalized, if you like, but around the idea is around every T, which is semi-normalized, I've created a linear space of semi-normalizers, and the whole of the semi-normalizers is such a union. So it seems to me that it's interesting to look a little bit more detailed in the structure of this space U phi, and No, I didn't say that. I didn't say that.
I'm not asking.
Well, that's my answer. I might come back to it a little bit. It's an interesting question. It's not so trivial. Initially, my initial reaction would have been, if you asked me 2 years ago, yeah, sure. But it's not true. Under certain conditions, you can achieve maximality. Under certain conditions. You see, okay, you've got me into it. There's lots of ways of defining this map phi t. That's one way of doing it. There's other maps that will give you subspaces with these properties. So it's not clear which is the maximal one. In some cases, you get maximal ones, but some others you don't. Anyway, the immediate properties that I want to look at from this U phi are the following. First of all, it's a reflexive linear space. It certainly satisfies, where is it? It certainly satisfies the last relation, since L is a projection. Secondly, it is ternary, triple. Okay, it satisfies this relation. It's easy to check because of this quasi-symmetry in this in the defining relation. That if you take three operators, it's not an algebra. If you take two operators and multiply them, they don't satisfy the relation. But if you take three of them and multiply them in this order, it's a triviality. It's a trivial calculation to see that the triple product will stay in there. And the third property that I want to look at is that the subspace is, well, not maximal, but saturated in the sense that it's a bimodule over the two diagonals of the algebras I have in mind. Now, since my algebras A and B are reflexive algebras, their diagonals are star algebras, unital, weak star closed, therefore Neumann algebras. So now, what I have here is a linear space consisting of semi-normalizers of the algebras I started with, which are non-self-adjoint. But now, this space is, first of all, linear and reflexive. Secondly, it's a TRO. And thirdly, it's a bimodule over two for Neumann algebras. Now, the reason I'm giving this talk at all is that these TROs have become fashionable in the last couple of years, and they turn up in all sorts of situations. They turn up in Morita equivalence. They're called Morita equivalence bimodules. They turned up in Baruch-Stokes. They were called C star modules or von Neumann modules or whatever. And they happen to be very fashionable these days. In fact, I am talking at the level of Hilbert space only, but Ivan Todorov has a paper in which he characterizes these TROs as operator spaces, abstractly. And characterization mimics an old one by Zettel, which characterizes them as Banach spaces. But anyway, I want to remain at this level. So what I've done up to now is, starting from a single operator that semi-normalizes B into A, I've constructed the whole linear space around it. I can be a little bit more general than that. And if I start from a linear space consisting of semi-normalizers, I can construct a ternary space around it consisting of semi-normalizers. Oh my God, yes, it's contained, right. Which is reflexive and is a bimodule. Okay. Right, so one would like to study these reflexive ternary spaces as spaces of operators, as opposed to operator spaces, if you know what I mean. And let's see, to be honest with you, when we did this, we didn't know what a TRO was. And therefore, we repeated some work that was already done, but our difference, our ingredient, is reflexivity. So the first result that you can say about these things is that such a linear space is reflexive in the sense that I had before, in the sense of Login of Shulman-Erdos, if and only if its weaks are closed. That statement is the analog of the phenomenon by Kometon theorem. Okay, a self-adjoint unital algebra is reflexive if and only if its weaks are closed. If you delete the word self-adjoint, it's not true. It's not true that a weaks are closed algebra of operators is reflexive if and only if its weaks are closed. But for these ternary things, it is true. And the reason, I mean, more or less the proof is in front of you. It is that it is in this 2x2 matrix business that these ternary linear spaces occur as corners of star algebras. And if the weaks are closed, they occur as corners of Feynman algebras, therefore they're reflexive. More or less that is the proof of that statement. Only we didn't know that language when we did the proof. But the proof we did is more or less that. So let's note here that by my definition of semi-normalizer normalizers, this corner here is a normalizer, consists of normalizers of the upper algebra, I don't need to take weak star closures, into the lower algebra. So I have a connection between TROs and normalizers. This 2x2 matrix picture is what appears when one considers Morita equivalence, at least in the case of Feynman algebras. At least when, I am not saying here that that you establish Morita equivalence between these two algebras. The thing missing is fullness. This U might not act non-degenerate just on the space. It might have a kernel. And if it has a kernel, you have to mod this out before you get a Morita equivalent by module. But in the case where both this linear space and this linear space act non-degenerately, in that case, this is exactly what is called the Morita equivalence by module between these two for Neumann algebras. So using this result or other properties of these ternary linear spaces, one can conclude, for example, that although, as I said, the set of semi-normalizers is not linear, it is generated by the partial isometries it contains. In fact, each semi-normalizer of B into A is a norm limit of sums of linear in the linear span of partial isometries. That is just an analog of the spectral theorem. That's all that says. Only I'm replacing, of course, projections by isometries because they're not necessarily any projections in a TRO. I'm being a bit too fast perhaps here. What? How to prove this is start with T. Create the UT that's around it, in there, do the analog of the spectral theorem, and now you've got the result. Another result that you can do, and that might be useful for Wern's talk perhaps, I'm not sure, is that if you have a reflexive ternary linear space, which happens to have lots of rank one operators, which makes it dear to my heart, then it has a very easy structure. It is a sum of full corners. And that makes it a bimodule over two masses, which on top of it are totally atomic. They are the masses generated by the projection onto the HNs, respectively the projection into the KNs. Okay, so that's a structure, for example, one doesn't see in nest algebras. One doesn't see this discreteness in nest algebras. In this case, it is true. And if you want to make this more believable, suppose you use a Feynman algebra, then what I say is true and trivial. Okay, so I think that's a sample of the general results one can have about these objects. And sorry, I should leave it. Oh no, there's another bunch of general results I want to talk to you about. Leave this here. And this is the phenomenon of synthesis. That's a totally Greek word. No. Yeah. So synthesis means music composition in Greek. In mathematics, I'm saying it for you. In mathematics, it means the definition of. Okay. Well, this was a bit quick. I wrote this last night. I'm sorry. Apologies. The slides are in the wrong order. I can't talk to you about this before I talk to you about mass of bimodules. I'm sorry. I ended up here telling you that in case your ternary linear space is generated by rank one operators, it turns out that it's a bimodule over masses. So that brings me to study mass of bimodules in general first. And the setting here is the following. Let us consider two standard Borel spaces, and let the two Hilbert spaces be the L2 spaces. Now, take any. I want to generalize the notion of support or spectrum or whatever else. I want to generalize this. Now, you see, since I'm in the not necessarily discrete case, I don't have points available. I'm in a measure space. Therefore, I have to think differently on how to define the support. Now, take any subset of the Cartesian product at all, no requirements, no measurability, no nothing. And I will say that an operator from H1 to H2 is supported by this set if the following happens. If you take a Borel rectangle disjoint from that set, then that rectangle will generate projections which kill the operator. So, here's your omega. I want to say what I mean by the operator living here. What it means is that if you take a rectangle out here and let the operator act from this Hilbert space to this Hilbert space, it will give you zero. Compress the operator to this corner, it will give you zero. That's the definition of what it is for a set to support an operator. That is a variant of a definition given by Iverson. I guess perhaps one could say that is what it means for the operator to be supported by omega in the sense of distributions. I mean, if one used that word, that covers everything. For example, if T happens to be an integral operator, it is exactly the support. If T happens to be generated by a measure, it is exactly the support of the measure, and so on and so forth. Now, I want to define a set of operators. Take any set and look at all the operators supported by the set omega and call this M max. M max happens to be reflexive and also happens to be a bimodule over the two multiplication masses. It is easy to see that it's a bimodule. The fact that it's a reflexive set comes from a characterization of reflexivity a la Hahn-Banach given by Dave Larson in the olden days. It actually is ancient history. That's it. This M max covers all possible reflexive mass of bimodules because the theorem that we proved with John Erdős and Victor Schulman is that every reflexive mass of bimodule occurs in this form. And to be more precise, what I'm saying is, I'm not saying it's unitarily equivalent to one of these. I'm saying the following. I'm saying if your Hilbert spaces are L2 spaces, and if your masses are the corresponding L infinity masses, then a reflexive mass of bimodule must be equal to an M max. And in fact, the omega that appears here, which we called the initially we called it the support in honor of Victor Shulman, but we didn't dare put that in the paper, and we called it the omega support, because you get to it by countable processes. So the support is it happens to be unique up to marginal equivalence. That is, up to a set which is marginally null in that way. Okay, so now I can tell you about synthesis, now that I've got massa by modules. Synthesis is a notion that was introduced again by the famous Greek Bill Arvidsson, and it is the following. In my setting, a set omega satisfies synthesis if there's only one weak star closed massa by module that has this set as support, M max. Okay, M max has support this omega. But there might be others. There might be smaller ones. If there are none, then we say that omega satisfies synthesis. The reason Arvidsson used this term is that you can have a representation of your Hilbert spaces in such a way that when you have synthesis, every operator in M max can be approximated by what are called pseudo-integral operators generated by measures. But I don't want to go into this, because this might mean that I would have to choose a representation. And I don't want to do that. I want to be independent of the representation. So it was discovered that synthesis is not automatic, that there are some sets that satisfy synthesis and some that not. And later on, of course, who was it? John Froelich was, it was, I think, that related this thing very clearly to spectral synthesis in the sense of harmonic analysis. Now, in our setting, in the setting of ternary massa bimodules, we get synthesis automatically. We get synthesis automatically. Not only that, we get what we call hereditary synthesis. Namely, if you have a weak star closed ternary massa bimodule, not only is it synthetic, but every sub bimodule of it is also synthetic. And the way you prove this is that if you have a subset of it, which is weak star closed and is a bimodule over the left algebra, it's automatically itself ternary. And therefore, it's synthetic, because we prove first that bimodules are synthetic. For example, if you have one-sided ideals over von Neumann algebras with a abelian commutant, then they are automatically synthetic in this sense. That is not a new result. That is in the original paper of Logarev and Shulman, but you can get it by these methods as well. That's why I'm mentioning it. So the question now is, if you have a massa bimodule of the form M max omega, how can you tell when it's ternary? And here's the answer. So M max of omega is ternary exactly when its support is marginally equivalent to a combination of two graphs. So it's not necessarily a graph. Where's the picture? I had a picture. So it's not necessarily a graph, but it is what you see. So for example, in the special case where one of the two algebras is abelian, I'm confusing here U and M max. U and M max, oh, I've written it, okay. In the case where one of the algebras is abelian, the support of a ternary massa bimodule is exactly a graph. In the case where, for example, the commutant of the algebra, well, since my U is a massa bimodule, the algebra U star contains a mass and therefore has a abelian commutant. If it's abelian itself, then it's a massa. So here, if it's not abelian, then its commutant is abelian but not a massa. Suppose it has a component, a massa component, and a component of uniform multiplicity 2, then the support will look like that. It will have a bit which is a graph, and another bit which is 2 by 2 matrices of a graph. and so on and so forth. If you decompose, if you have a general abelian phenomenon algebra here, and you decompose into components of uniform multiplicity, you will get bits of graphs like that. So that's one way to characterize ternary mass bimodules, and I've already spoken about this. Another way in which M-max can be ternary, again equivalence, if it has the 3 implies 4 property. I think Verne calls this the 3 out of 4 property, but here it is. This is sort of cute. It's the following. If your support has the following property, whenever it has 3 points like this, then it has the fourth point in it as well. That's the 3 implies 4 property. So what I'm saying is that M max of omega is ternary if and only if its support has this property, which of course you have to reinterpret in terms of marginally null sets, but that's the essence of it. And at least when you choose coordinates in a way in which your support becomes a closed subset of a topological space, then that is actually exactly true. Yet another way in which you can determine when a mass bimodule is ternary is the following. Come back to that picture of U phi. Maybe I ought to write it down. So you had this map phi, which I didn't specify very much, and U phi was all operators that did this for all L in, and I didn't say. The reason I didn't say is that you could arrange it so that this is satisfied for all L in the projection lattice of everything, for all projections. But a smaller set usually suffices. A smaller set usually suffices. When you can choose your set of projections to be in a commutative subspace lattice, that's a term from antiquity that also reappeared yesterday, then this U phi is again a mass bimodule, but you can do more. And you can prove that U phi is, well, first of all, such a U phi is necessarily ternary. I said this earlier. So the issue here is whether it is a mass bimodule or not. I say when it is a mass bimodule if and only if you can choose your question mark here to be a nest, a totally ordered chain of subspaces. Okay? So if you can do that, then you get ternary mass bimodule. Conversely, if you have a ternary mass bimodule, then by playing with the support, you can construct a nest that suffices to generate U phi. I am done, I think. Yes, thank you very much.
By ternary, simply that T
and
star is contained.
Yeah.
So what about if omega is simply space oriented?